From KCRW, this is DNA, Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. DJ Waldie is a Los Angeles writer who finds the soul in this region.
I am persuaded that everything talks to everything else, that in some fashion, the trees talk to the streetlights, that talk to the clouds passing overhead, that talk to the grid of streets around them, that talk to me. And my book is my attempt to convey that experience to you.
Hear about DJ Waldie's new book, Becoming Los Angeles, coming up. Before that, we're going to talk about air conditioning, and why they matter in the time of COVID-19.
We anticipate to both have the fans on so that we're constantly turning over and exchanging the air, but in those spaces where we can, we'll also have the windows and the doors open, which is completely inefficient, but it will increase the amount of air exchange which is necessary during this pandemic.
Kerry Upton is the Chief Operations Officer for the Santa Monica Malibu Unified School District. The district is amending an AC system that they were in the midst of installing before COVID struck. And they're making some changes to the system because ventilation has become a life or death factor in the transmission of coronavirus. Researchers have found that one of the most common ways in which the infection is transmitted is among people grouped indoors, expelling tiny airborne droplets. To get rid of those droplets or to dilute it, the AC has to be filtered properly or mixed with frequent intakes of fresh air. This matters so much, says Kerry Upton, that his school district is also considering adding this.
Either a UV lighting system or an ionization system that does kill bacteria, mold, and viruses, or allows you to capture and nullifies them. And so that's something we're looking at putting in. It's a little expensive. It would be about $2,000 per room.
All of this also increases the use of energy, which then contributes to another existential challenge, climate change. So there is another approach, and that is, wherever possible, to rely less on mechanical air conditioning and more on that substance called air.
The best way actually to create a healthy environment is to have fresh air coming in into the building and creating air circulations. I mean, that's a very old passive idea, very prevalent in kind of old architectures in the Middle East, where you try to create air circulation to move the air and bring in fresh air.
Rastan Zaitlian is an architect who recently renovated an office building in Santa Monica. There he made a feature of the openable windows and access to balconies. Now, this might seem kind of obvious, but for many decades, we have been sealing ourselves into buildings, shutting off the fresh air. I called him to find out more about his project.
Well, it's all related to the pandemic condition that we are in. And how do we address it in meaningful ways through design to be able to partake in combating the spread of the virus? So the best way to do that is through design, through architecture, and to find ways of allowing for a healthier workspace environment. And the way you can do that is certainly by mechanical systems that could be state of the art, but then you're relying on replacing filters. So in this building in Santa Monica, we decided to take advantage of the California weather and the slight breeze in Santa Monica and to allow for natural air to come into the building. And it works on several levels. One is the actual physical air circulation by having operable panels that open out to balconies, but also has a really psychological dimension as well, to create a symbolic as well as physical relationship with the outdoors.
You mentioned that in the architecture of the Middle East, the creators of those buildings figured out ways to maintain air circulation and cross ventilation and so on. And absolutely, they did traditionally. But even in the Middle East now, where people can have air conditioning, they will. So, and that's certainly true of many Angelenos. Many Angelenos don't want fresh air if it's extremely hot air. They want to cool it down. How do you make the case for not having air conditioning and for enjoying the fresh air, even if it does tend a bit hot?
Well, there's a certain way of designing where that would not be the case. I mean, you could literally design a building in such a way by studying the wind patterns and orienting openings toward the existing breezes. It is actually quite possible to do completely naturally ventilated building. We are working on another project in Pasadena, which is a lot hotter than Santa Monica, where we're trying to do exactly that, to kind of alleviate the mechanical ventilation of a multi-family building to a minimum possible. And we're doing that by creating open air circulation corridors that are shaded, a courtyard that's fully shaded and brings, you know, amazingly cool air throughout the building. The other thing is that and I mentioned this at the beginning, there's a psychological aspect to this as well. The feeling of cool or hot is also related to a sense of like connecting with the exterior. So when you have access to fresh air, the perception of heat is very different than if you are in a completely closed space. So that's also a factor, this kind of a poetic connection to the exterior and to nature, to the sky and the environment, come also to play into this equation.
What you say makes perfect sense, especially for the West Side. What if someone's listening to this and they are living over near a freeway intersection? You know, they're living in a part of LA where there's really not very pleasant air. What's the answer there?
Well, if you're like living right next to the freeway, it would be very difficult to mitigate. But there's ways to create like vertical landscaping as a way of naturally keeping some of the pollutants away from the windows or the balconies, and creating as many barriers as possible. Proximity to the freeway, you know, it still is an unhealthy condition. And I think, you know, it's very difficult to mitigate. So definitely you're going to have to rely more on the filtration of the mechanical system, the filters that are used. And you're also relying on the management changing those filters.
Sure. This thinking about, or this emphasis that's being put on quality of air, access to air, better air conditioning, has absolutely been intensified by the pandemic.
Absolutely. I would say that's central right now. In any meetings in renovations or brand new buildings, the central question is, how can we create the healthiest building possible, and how can we combat this pandemic, or even, you know, future other aberrations of this pandemic or other pandemics? So that's fundamental. A big responsibility really is on the mechanical engineers, but architects as the generalists come into play, and that's where I think the value of architecture is, in coming up with alternative ways of addressing the pandemic, not just through the kind of like limited science or mechanical engineering, but just more holistically based on the traditions of architecture in the past, and how we can bring those notions of the healthy building that has always been around since time immemorial into this new design environment and the new challenges with the pandemic.
Raztan, thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Frances. This was a great pleasure.
That was architect Raztan Saikalian talking about making air a feature in his recent renovation of an office building in Santa Monica. And we should add that a recent surprise report in the Los Angeles Times found the following. People living on the streets in Los Angeles are being infected with coronavirus at lower rates than the housed. Of course, the unhoused are susceptible to many health issues and challenges, but the low rates of COVID infections are being credited to the fact of living outside. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to the DNA podcast. And now onto a book by one of the great interpreters of Los Angeles. DJ Waldy first came to attention in 1996 when he published Holy Land, a suburban memoir. This was a poetic meditation on growing up in the blue-collar, post-war suburban city of Lakewood. Since then, he has written many more books about the Southland. His latest is Becoming Los Angeles: Myth, Memory, and a Sense of Place. It is published by Angel City Press, and it is a book of many small revelations, befitting a writer who is deeply concerned with finding the soul in a city that is often seen as skin deep. It's also a bookend to Holy Land.
Part of this book was a dialogue with my former self. And there's actually a section of Becoming Los Angeles in which I talk about myself as if I were in the past. The me of 1995 is not the me of 2020. And I see the world and my experience of Los Angeles in a different way.
I do feel, DJ, that in this book, more than in your past books, there's a far greater consciousness of the role that structural or systemic racism has played in the founding and evolution of Los Angeles. Are you looking at your own city through that lens more than you once did?
You're entirely right, Francis. Los Angeles begins as an American city in 1850 in opposition to the Latino indigenous communities that had been there in some instances for thousands of years. So that Los Angeles as a place of opposition to whatever might be called other is a theme that threads all the way through the city's past and into its design, into its layout, into the way it looks. It's just amazing how we have to think of Los Angeles not as an outpost of East Coast civilization marching across the continent. We have to think of Los Angeles as a connecting point, north and south, east and west. Los Angeles has always been a global city. Even when it was a dusty cow town, flea-bitten and violent, it was a crossroads of the continent, trans-Pacific, subtropical, and tropical. We have to think about Los Angeles always in those global terms. It's the only way we can understand the city's troubles and its potentials.
You just mentioned the subtropical climate of Los Angeles. And one of the things that I find so fascinating about your book is that it's full of small revelations. And one of those small revelations is the recontextualizing of the Los Angeles climate.
Again, we're talking about an imaginative construct. You have Anglo leaders, new possessors of Los Angeles after 1850. And they look around them and they see the indigenous native population, the Latino population, and they claim, this is 1850 now, not today, they claim that those peoples were failures at civilizing this landscape, of improving this landscape, because the climate had made them lazy, indolent, unfocused. It lulled them into a kind of sleepy provincialism. But now that we Americans have arrived, they said in 1850, we bring with us a sterner constitution, and we will improve this land that the original possessors couldn't improve because of the way that the climate had reduced their ability to do that. So this has this weird doubleness. The climate was bad for those people, but good for us.
And as I understand it from your book, while this area was determined by geographers as subtropical, that definition was actually changed to differentiate it from steamy, hot places where people sit around doing nothing.
Yes, a new language had to be invented to describe what Los Angeles, what the climate of Los Angeles is. And it's not subtropical, which conjures up images of rainforests and steamy jungles. It became semi-tropical, and even to the point became semi-tropic, sort of a newly invented word that didn't really mean anything except what the sellers of real estate in Los Angeles wanted it to mean. But it seems to me, when you look at the imagery of marketing Los Angeles, that semi-tropic really meant a kind of a landscape in which a New England farmhouse, classic East Coast structure, would have planted in front of it both a rose bush and a cactus.
So in this book, we learn so much about the history, the people that have made this region. We also learn about your experience living in the city of Lakewood. And for you, Lakewood is emblematic of a certain kind of life that was once lived in Los Angeles. And in fact, in Becoming Los Angeles, you quote from a promotional brochure about Lakewood. See how well Kaiser engineers and architects have interpreted the desires of Mr. and Mrs. Modern in Lakewood. Built between 1950 and 1953, being modern meant aluminum windows, stainless steel countertops, and a garbage disposal unit in every kitchen sink, making Lakewood, the sales brochure said, America's first garbage-free city. This kind of description plays right into our collective perception of mid-century America in all its brightness and optimism. You were living in the so-called first garbage-free city, was it?
Well, we didn't have to put out garbage pails. That was at least one thing on trash day, which was not so true of many other parts of Los Angeles County. Francis, I have to tell you that growing up in Lakewood, I was conscious that the city had been sold to the hopeful thousands who moved there as being something bright and shiny and modern and pointed like a rocket into the future. But to me, it just felt like home. It was just a place where I lived. Small houses on small lots, most of them under 1,000 square feet, a few of them a little bit larger than that, one bathroom, a front yard to play in, a backyard to barbecue in, and a place where children roamed free range and socialized each other, I suppose. It seemed like a wonderful life, and I would wish others could experience it, but I know that there were many, many, many other thousands who were denied the opportunity that I had. It was denied the opportunity my parents had to own one of these small houses and to live a decent, dignified life in a well-run new community. And this is the crime. This is the sin. This is the burden that all Southern California suburbs bear. All the post-war suburbs bear, that they were made for working-class people, but some working-class people were prevented from living there.
I think there's a confessional tone in Becoming Los Angeles, direct from your soul. Are you, if I may ask, are you Catholic, DJ?
Oh, yeah.
And do you think that plays into some of your sensitivities?
It does. Francis, not to get too philosophical on you, my faith tradition emphasizes the bodily. It emphasizes contact with people and things. My faith tradition makes me acutely aware of the sacred qualities that might be inherent in ordinary things, a wafer of bread, a cup of wine, a relic of a saint. These things are meaningful to me as a consequence of what I believe. And that's made me, if I can say this, it has made me more attentive to the ordinary stuff of everyday life. And it allows me, perhaps only imaginatively, to invest those ordinary things with a certain sacred quality.
Now, DJ, as you well know, the image of LA is that of a very material place, filled with many people who acquire lots of stuff, houses, cars, clothes, beauty treatments. That is absolutely not your way of life. Your life seems to almost stand in opposition to the way that Angelenos are kind of expected to live. Are you aware of how much you embody a very different way of being an Angeleno?
I'm fully aware of it. As a lifelong non-driver, I know that I am not fully an Angeleno. Unlike Rainer Banham, who learned to drive when he came to Los Angeles from England, said he learned to drive so he could read Los Angeles in the original. I have never learned to drive, and so I presumably have not ever read Los Angeles in the original. But I think my book tries to show how one person, and then through the examples of some other people, other Angelenos, tries to show through my example and other examples, how someone can acquire a genuine sense of place and I think offer an opportunity for a reader to reflect on how he or she might make use of the materials of their everyday life to acquire their own sense of place.
Yes, in your book, you absolutely single out very interesting individuals. For example, Kevin Starr, the great historian of the state of California. You also identify aspects of Los Angeles life in which you find amusement, perhaps sometimes a little melancholy, a little frustration, and irony. All of that is contained in the helicopter and the telecopter. You have this fascinating paragraph. The air-ground conflict is just another part of the familiar Los Angeles bait and switch. We're always being pitched one bright future and end up getting a darker, more troublesome one. Personal helicopters were promised in the 1950s, whisking commuters to downtown jobs and taking the family on a joyride to Palm Springs. Instead, the future turned out to be hedge fund billionaires and Hollywood bold-faced names copturing over Los Angeles to avoid the gridlocked rest of us below. Just expand on your reflections on the role of the helicopter in Los Angeles life.
Well, you know, Francis, the helicopter is a big part, but only a part, of what might be called aeriality in Los Angeles. We have a propensity in Los Angeles to see the city and our lives in it from about 5,000 feet in the air. I think that's a problem. So helicopters are kind of a metaphor for me for a perspective on place that is distancing and remote that seems to provide a kind of all-seeing eye, but which really misses an awful lot about what's going on down on the ground. So we see car chases and hostage situations from the helicopters, and that's our image of Los Angeles, a place seen from 5,000 feet or 1,000 feet in the air, in which we have very little contact. We can watch it, but it doesn't really touch us in any material way. I'm a pedestrian. I'm down on the ground all the time. My footfall hit the concrete of the sidewalk. And I kind of laugh at the idea that we can understand Los Angeles from the perspective of a news channel's helicopter. That's not how we really can't understand where we are.
And because you are a pedestrian with your feet firmly on the ground, you have a tremendous capacity and opportunity for observation. You write a lot about the buildings in LA, and one specifically that you've studied very carefully is Union Station. And aside from its architecture and the messaging in its architecture, you talk very interestingly about the tiling and the patterning there. Can you explain?
In many cultures, particularly in Islamic cultures, repetitive pattern is the principal design motif. And that repetitive pattern has a kind of philosophical support. Regular patterns repeating over and over, even in intricate detail, are said to reflect the orderliness of divine thought, that human skill creates these patterns of colors and shapes, which is like the divine skill creating patterns of life in the universe. So there's a kind of religious iconography in what looks to be like just a regular repeating series of colors and shapes. I am in sympathy with those thoughts. I find that view of design to be a satisfying view of design, that there is reason in pattern that I find emotionally satisfying.
And what about the architecture of Union Station? You say it tells us a lot about the aspirations of Los Angeles.
Precisely. The Union Station is the culmination of 40 years of Los Angeles aspirations. The creation of a symbol that would stand for what the movers and shakers, the power brokers of Los Angeles wanted Los Angeles to be. Union Station is a hybrid form. It looks back to Spain, looks back to Moorish Spain, it looks back to North Africa. It looks towards the Spanish and Mexican colonial periods in Los Angeles. It also has a sort of Art Deco, streamlined, modern thrust into what was hoped to be a bright future. So this building kind of materializes beliefs about where Los Angeles came from and beliefs about where Los Angeles was going. Now, some of those beliefs were mistaken, and others were exclusive and prejudicial. But the building is that embodiment. I mean, that's what I find so amazingly interesting about places like Union Station. It's thinking in stone and concrete about what this place is supposed to mean.
Becoming Los Angeles seems to be beckoning us to contemplate our roots, our even rootedness in this kind of rootless land. So I'm going to conclude with a metaphor for rootedness, which is, of course, trees. You wrote what I found to be an absolutely beautiful paragraph about the trees in Lakewood. If I may read it back to you, you write, "I walk while the thumbnail curve of the waning moon rides brightly in and out of the arms of the sycamores, maples and liquid ambars that line some blocks near my home. They had been planted with bureaucratic efficiency in front of each house, but contingent nature has taken this plan and twisted it, and the trees are no longer just instances of a scheme. Each tree is itself, bent or straight, thick or slim, and each is different in every season." What a wonderful paragraph, and what a metaphor it seems to be for the individuals here and for Los Angeles itself.
Yes. I am persuaded that everything talks to everything else, that in some fashion, the trees talk to the streetlights, that talk to the clouds passing overhead, that talk to the grid of streets around them, that talk to me. I hear a vast murmuring conversation going on around me in which the world is explaining itself to me. And my book is my attempt to convey that experience to you.
Well, it's really a pleasure. Thank you so much, DJ.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Francis. You be well.
And you. And you. DJ Waldy is the author of Becoming Los Angeles: Myth, Memory, and a Sense of Place. I'm Frances Anderton, and if you want to listen to my DNA reports on KCRW's other programs, find out about them in the DNA newsletter. Subscribe at kcrw.com/newsletters. Thank you for listening to the DNA podcast. Stay tuned and stay well.